Okay, what we're going to try to do today is give an answer to an often asked, or perhaps a question that goes unasked, that should be asked, and give an answer that is probably very much underappreciated. Okay, everybody has a source sheet? Sasha, you have a source sheet?
Yeah.
Okay. So take a look at source number one. I don't know, you guys ever like stayed up the whole night on Shavuos morning?
Yeah.
And so how do you manage to stay up all night?
Drugs.
Close. Cheesecake and soda, right?
Regular naps.
Regular naps. So, you know, here you are standing up like the whole night and you're eating like cheesecake and soda and just something, you know, like studying, right? When you're doing pulling an all-nighter, what do? You just...
Oh,
because
you have to
hear it. You don't have to, but whatever. That's what anyway, so you kind of just like plug yourself, just stuff yourself with some sort of caffeine or something to keep yourself going, you know? So you'd imagine that by the time that you're davening Shacharis in the morning, you're probably seeing all kinds of things, you know, angels flying around. And then you read the Haftorah, and it's the vision of Yechezkel's vision. Yeah? That's source number one. Source number one, this is what Kabbalah is like, based on Yechezkel's vision. So take a look at this. It kind of blows you away when you start to read it. Ezekiel was one of the major prophets. Ezekiel. Yeah, Ezekiel.
Okay. So where is this written? Is it
in
Navi or
something? Can you pass off this one?
Oh, yeah.
Yeah, this is Ezekiel. Ezekiel himself wrote one of the books of Tanakh called Ezekiel. And this is taken from the very, very beginning of Ezekiel. This is his vision itself. He actually was the prophet that actually had some sort of vision of God and his throne, his chariot. Yeah, so this is very impressive. It happened in the 30th year, in the 4th month, in the 5th of the month. As I was among the exile, he was one of the prophets that had gone into exile with the Jewish people after the destruction of the first temple. And he was by the river Kvar. The heavens opened and I saw visions of God. On the 5th of the month, which is in the 5th year of the exile of King Jehoiakim, find out when it was, the word of God came to Yechezkel, then Nebuzi, the Kohen, in the land of the Chaldeans by the river Kvar, and the hand of God came upon him there. I saw, so this is Yechezkel speaking. What did he see in this vision? Behold, there was a stormy wind coming from the north, a great cloud with flashing fire and a brilliance surrounding it, and from its midst, like the color of the chashmal in the midst of the fire. At this point, we're like just totally confused, right? We have no idea what he's talking about.
The first time the word is used.
What? Yeah, that's where it comes from. We use it to mean electricity in modern Hebrew, but that's where it comes from. So that's a problem in the translation. He's trying to describe a vision he had. So Chashmal in modern Hebrew means electricity. Take it easy. All right. So, but listen to this, okay? And in its midst, there was a likeness of four chayos. What are chayos?
Animals.
Yeah, but animals
wild
are
animals,
actually,
wild
right? Animals. Right. Yeah. A chayo, as opposed to a behem, a domesticate, right? Very good. So there were these a likeness, they weren't really animals, but it was a likeness of four animals. This was their appearance. They had the likeness of a man. Each one had four faces, and each one of them had four wings. Their legs were like a straight leg, and the sole of their feet was like the sole of a rounded foot, and they glittered with the color of burnished copper. There were human hands under their wings on their four sides. Their faces and their wings were alike on the four of them. Their wings were joined to one another, and they did not turn as they went. Each in the direction of its faces they would go. So, now he describes the likeness of their faces. That's why it's underlined and then bolded over here. Pay attention to this.
Can I get a paper?
Yeah,
here, it's a whole pile right in the middle. As for the likeness of their faces, there was a human face and a lion's face to the right for the four of them. We got, what do we have so far? We got a human face, we have a lion's face, we have an ox's face to the left, and an eagle's face to the four of them. So there were four faces, we're in source number one, in the bolded underlined part. So this is the likeness. So when Yechezkel sees this vision, he sees these animals surrounding this throne of God, this chariot of God. And that's what the four faces each look like. A human, a lion, an eagle, and
an ox.
astronauts.
What's a twin chariot of God?
Oh.
What's his name? Eliyahu.
No, so this is the vision of Yechezkel.
No, what is this chariot of God?
Oh, so yeah, that's what we're... So if you skip towards the end of this first page, he says, that was the appearance of the likeness of the glory of Hashem. When I saw, I fell upon my face, and I heard a voice speaking. So if you read through this whole thing, you get the impression that there's, you know, God over here somewhere. Yeah, but we're going to see.
What's the point of
this? Well, I just want to give you something to think about. Then we're just going to leave it and come back to it later. It's just for suspense. Take a look at source number 2. This is also from Yechezkel, but this is in chapter 10. So this is a little bit later. The glory of Hashem then went forth from upon the threshold of the temple. In other words, he had a vision of God's glory in this vision of a temple. And stood upon the
cherubim.
Cherubim, right? Which he's saying he was cherubim. What's this week's parsha?
Cherub.
Not cherub, but karu. So what's this entire parsha's truma? The parsha's truma, the very beginning. So that's when Moses is instructed to build this tabernacle, the Mishkan. And what's the first thing he's instructed to build?
Mishkan.
Not the structure itself, actually, funny enough.
The
ark, which has on top of it these cherubs, these cherubim. Because inside the ark was the tablets, the broken ones and the whole ones. Ten commandments are written on them.
First
one. Are the pieces of the Ten Commandments?
Yeah, both the broken ones and the whole ones, right? So the glory of Hashem went forth from the threshold, then stood upon the cherubim. The cherubim then lifted their wings and rose to the surface before my eyes as they went forth. The Ophanim, another type of angel opposite them, and it, the Merkava chariot, this throne of God, this chariot of God, stood at the entrance of the eastern gate of the temple of Hashem, and the glory of the God of Israel was upon them from above. So here you have this vision he's having of these cherubim, these cherubs, and God is on top of them, riding on them, something like that. This was the Chaya that I had seen beneath the God of Israel at the river Kabar. I realized that they were cherubim. It's like the funniest thing. You know how we have a dream, and you're like, I was in the library, but it was my house. You know, I was at home, but it was the library. But it seems like that's what kind of what he's describing him. And he's seeing one thing, but it's really something else, but it's the same thing. That seems to be what he's struggling to explain. That's what it sounds like on the weird surface of this, yeah? We're not going into this. But in any case, that's what he says. So what I'm trying to point out to you, and he goes on to describe it again, the same thing he described in chapter 1. So when you connect chapter 1 and chapter 10, you end up with, bottom line, is that Yechezkel has this vision of God's chariot or throne, whatever you'd like to call it, and it has these things called chayos. These chayos, which means modern, which means in Hebrew, means animals, right? But these chayos are a type of angel. They have four faces. Four faces, please.
Eagle, ox, lion,
person.
Very good. And then, when we come back to it, Yechezkel comes back to the same vision. He sees it again later, but this time he sees that God is riding on top of what?
Sure.
No, but he says he's on top of something. He stood upon the
cherubim,
the cherubim. And he says that was the same thing that I saw before.
Right.
Okay, good? Okay, good, I just want to share that with you. Okay, so now today, what we're going to talk about is...
What
happened to prayer? I have no idea. So...
What?
I don't know. It was a total tangent. I thought it was really interesting.
It says at the top of the page.
We'll come back to it. What does it say at the top of the page?
Why pray in a synagogue?
Right? Whoever can make the connection between this vision of Yechezkel and the synagogue, you get an A for the class. Anyone want to try?
I'm not that smart. That's
okay,
smart.
Right. You can make a connection to anything we just talked about in a synagogue.
In a synagogue.
So that's what this class is.
God sits on the synagogue.
Right.
Yeah, I don't see that.
Okay, give me a chance.
Alright. I know.
Yeah, you have a suggestion?
Yeah.
What do you say?
One is because the way that God is writing the cherubim is the way that we are supposed to be in. And other than the four faces, are the four different types of people, right? Come on. Yeah, come on.
It's not what I was thinking.
Well, but just because it's not what you were thinking doesn't mean it's not a good reason.
But he asked me. He's like, right, Rabbi? Oh, that was thinking. Okay.
And then the writing the cherubim.
Did you see the picture I tagged with you?
Unfortunately, so did some other people. Yeah.
The same way,
like my wife.
Yesterday, remember about that picture? That's good. You're smiling like right next to your artwork.
Anyway, so here's the question that is should be asked and is often unasked, and the answer is certainly underappreciated, and that is, why should I dominate? Sure, Rabbi.
I know. Why?
Does this bother anybody?
Yes.
No. Anybody bother why should I have a shul?
No, it's obvious.
Why is it obvious?
Because you want to have a community. You want to be...
Abe is very pragmatic and practical. And that's what I like about Abe. You know, what do you mean, Rabbi? I got a question is that everybody knows you want to be involved with the Jewish people. What do you're just going to pray at home all the time? You're not even going to know when Rosh Chodesh is. You know what I'm saying?
Not that I'm not saying
unless
that
you got one of those cool watches.
That
you
know, I do it, but I'm saying that's the reason.
Oh, all right.
I do it.
Why? Well, why? Yeah, okay, once a week, not bad. Why? Why? Why social? Social scene. Yeah?
It's a thing to do.
For the girls, I
They're on the other side of the wall.
Yeah. Not in my shul.
Kind of keep you away from them.
I go to temple to.
Look, it's closer than we are. Why?
So, there are a lot of practical, good practical reasons why we should pray in a synagogue. I would like, of course, that's not how Rabbi Berman ever answers questions, right? Rabbi Berman is so not practical. Rabbi Berman has other things in mind. He likes deep things. So, I'm going to try and explain to you the significance of a shul in a very deep way. That's what I'm going to try and do. No? You don't like that
shit? I like shallow stuff.
But Jerry wants something shallow. So, okay, talk to Abe. No, not that Abe, you're saying
whoa,
shallow.
Whoa,
practical.
Whoa.
Practical.
Whoa.
Practical.
Whoa.
Okay.
Shall we talk, my friends? I see you're the expert of shallowness.
Apparently, I was appointed.
1 year on Shavuos. You know, there's this tradition that we have to learn all night on Shavuos, right? I mentioned before. So at the time, my my 6-year-old was insisting that he has to learn all night. And he made it. He made it until davening. He fell asleep during davening. But he made it. So I had to find something to learn. I had to find something to learn with a 6-year-old, you know, all night long, right? So what are you going to learn with a 6-year-old? So I found this great book. The Chafetz Chaim, right? Everyone knows who the Chafetz Chaim was, right?
Never spoke a word of love tomorrow.
Very good. So the Chafetz Chaim wrote a book called The Shortened or Concise Book of Mitzvot, right? Because everyone knows 613 is way too many to deal with, so let's just shave some off. The Shortened Book of Mitzvot is much easier to handle, right? Why did he call it that? He wrote a book that lists and explains all mitzvot that are applicable today. Today, every single mitzvah that we can fulfill from the Torah today. I forgot how many there are. 281 or something? 277, 281, something like that.
You're slipping, Rabbi. You're slipping in your old age.
I think the Chofetz Chaim list, I think, if memory serves, something like 281.
Is that a few minutes in this class? It's a really bad question.
So this is what he writes. You take a look at his source sheet, source number 3. This is the introduction of the Chofetz Chaim to his book. He just writes, therefore, source number 3. This is just his introduction. He says, I have collected here, Be'ezus Hashem Yisbarach, with the help of God, in this one little book, all of the mitzvot, asay, the positive commandments, the Efrelam is one of the Kaiman. All the positive commandments we can do, and all of the prohibitions that we're not supposed to do, as the Rambam and other Rishonim, may their memory be for blessing, have taught us. Yeah, so that's his purpose in this book. So I got to Mitzvah 18, which is source number 4. What's the title of this mitzvah? Do you guys see it? Source number 4. Mitzvah Saseh. That's the you see it's Yud Ches, right? This list, source number 4. Mitzvah Saseh.
Okay. What's that saying?
Mitzvah Saseh.
Oh, okay.
Is it a positive commandment? Yirah. What's Yirah?
To see. To shoot. Yirah.
It's
all to fry, but in this case, it's respect.
Yeah, to fear. Okay, literally, let's keep it literal for now. Yeah, it means to fear. Yeah? To fear what?
from the holy.
Right. Minha Mikdash. What is the Mikdash reference to?
The Aron.
Jared, what's Mikdash?
The Aron.
What's
funny?
What's a Mikdash? The base? Ha Mikdash?
The base of sacrifice?
The temple, all right? I don't have to get complicated.
Oh, why did you...
You just like superficial stuff. I'm giving you a chance.
I thought you wanted a deep answer, Rabbi. He's the superficial expert, not me.
So wait, who's writing this stuff? Don't spend also writing that one?
Yeah. This is from the paper itself. So Chofetz Chaim writes, there is a positive commandment today to fear the...
Lord.
The temple.
Yeah, don't go. That's why people don't go. They're afraid.
There's a positive command to the fear of the temple. What does he mean? What do you think he's going to say?
I mean, it represents God.
Wait, what's he going to say? Remember, applicable today.
The sin of God.
He's a respect. You don't talk because God's there.
What? What did he just say? What's a positive commandment? To fear the
temple.
How is that applicable today?
We have many respect, but not the temple.
If not, it's like a
commandment from the Torah, right? These are the commandments from the Torah applicable today. What?
Our equivalent today of temple is synagogues. So,
that's what it
says. Right?
But it's not really equivalent. I mean,
so when I saw this, I'll tell you what I thought he was going to say. Before I read it, I thought the Chofetz Chaim was going to say, have any of you ever been to the Western Wall?
Yes.
Raise your hand if you've not been to the Western Wall. Pow! Why not?
No,
what are you waiting for?
No time.
Oh, make time.
Wait.
You can go on, what's that trip? Yeah, you've never been to
Europe? Yeah, and I'll be done with graduate school.
Come before.
You should go during the winter or summer.
You should go. Anyway, so, has anyone here ever been on the Temple Mount?
No.
Oh, is that where the little Arab farm?
Yeah, the top.
Why not?
I was right outside their big green gates.
Yeah.
Why didn't you guys go up there?
On the steps. Right?
Why didn't you go on top?
I did.
You did? All the way on top?
Yeah, on the steps.
Because there's
you went on top to where the Dome of the Rock is?
No, I didn't.
Why not?
Actually, this is the reason. You're not allowed to go. There are certain areas you're not supposed to.
See, I thought the Chofetz Chaim was going to say that there's a mitzvah today to fear the temple. Meaning, even though the temple's been destroyed, there's a certain like status, you know, to the area even today. So you have to have fear of the area, despite the fact the temple isn't there. That's what I thought he was going to say.
Fear of the area where the temple was.
Right. Makes sense, right?
Alright.
I mean, it doesn't have to be necessarily the structure. There's a sanctity to the place.
And that's what we're doing.
That's what I thought he was going to say. But it's not what he says. That's the thing. As the Pasuk says, he quotes the source of Mikdashichi Ro, that you're supposed to be afraid of the Mikdash, of the temple. And this, as some of you did point out, he says this is a mitzvah from the Torah today. Get ready for this. Buckle your seatbelts. Ubate kinesios, ubate midrashos shalanu. Our synagogues and our study halls are called Bate Mikdash Ma'at, miniature temples. He takes this very seriously. Because again, Yechezkel tells us that when the temple will be destroyed, because remember, Yechezkel, as we just pointed out, was the one that actually went into exile with the Jews.
Which one?
I will be, actually, the first temple was destroyed. He went into exile. There were no prophets by the time of the second temple. I mean, in the second temple period. So he says, God says to Yechezkel that I will be for them in the exile for a miniature temple. So there will be miniature temples in exile. So therefore it's a reference, says the Gemara, the Talmud, source 5, says that's what it means. It's a reference to synagogues and study halls in exile are called miniature temples. So what's the halacha, what's the Torah law that the Chofetz Chaim says we have even today? Is to be careful when you're in shul from joking around and saying things that are unnecessary and doing talking about stocks or your taxes or any other calculations.
He says that?
And you're not... Yeah. So you can't make calculations in that. Stocks is included in
calculations.
I mean, stocks is probably nonsense, right? Yeah. But really? No, he says you're not allowed to talk about business deals.
You're
not allowed
to... Going to donate to the school, to the shul.
Okay, meaning for mitzvah purposes, it only has to be the shul.
Always 24/7 or just on Shabbos?
He's talking about walking into a shul. You're inside the shul.
24/7, when you're in the shul,
correct.
You cannot talk about this stuff.
That's right.
It's a little extreme.
What do you mean? He says it's a temple. And you're not allowed to sleep in that. Kedusha Simcha Mura Ma'o, their sanctity.
Yeah. What about that?
Their sanctity is very great. V'noi b'chol magom b'chol zman v'zichar nekevos, it's customary, it applies every place, all times, both males and females. So let's trace this a little bit. And this is going to help us appreciate, of course, what's the significance of a synagogue. This is, of course, what I'm getting at.
Who's that famous figure who just puts feet in cold water to keep himself from falling asleep?
Nah, I don't know, all rabbis, you know.
So, but then they do fall asleep.
You are 100% correct. There is certain permission for people that are basically living in a study hall. There are certain leniencies for them. Because that's where they are all the time.
Yeah.
But that's specifically a study hall, by the way. That's not applicable to a synagogue. A synagogue is a place which is not a study hall. It's a place people go only to pray. Most synagogues are created that they have in mind. When we're making it, it's also going to be a place for people to come and learn. So it has a status, it has those leniencies in a synagogue as well. What?
Not so much.
Okay, I'm saying, but that's, in other words, that's important in terms of the status of the synagogue. Is it considered a synagogue only, or is it also considered a study hall? What's the difference? The difference is whether or not it has certain leniencies for eating and sleeping and things like that. Not dozing off a little nap or whatever. Yeah.
If we go by this, that the synagogue is a miniature temple, how come Orthodox
That goes back to the Reform philosophy that you don't need a temple in Jerusalem anymore.
So we don't need a temple because it implies big temple as opposed to mini temple?
Right, correct. We have a lot of customs. Sephardim and Ashkenazim differ a little bit on this, which is interesting. But take, for example, Pesach. On Pesach, we point to all of the different items on the Seder plate and say that, you know, this is the matzah, this is the maror, but we don't say this is the Korban Pesach. Remember that? You guys know this?
Yeah.
When you're going in the Haggadah, we point out everything that's on the Seder plate because we're supposed to have in front of us three things. The sacrifice, the Korban Pesach Hatel, matzah and maror. Well, matzah and maror we do have in front of us. We point to it. We say, this is the matzah, this is the maror. But the Korban Pesach, we don't point to because we don't want people to think we have it anymore. The Ashkenazim have a minhag. They don't even have roasted meat at the Seder. So no one should get confused. The Sephardim go out of their way to have roasted meat so that we can remember the Korban Pesach. See, it's an interesting difference in approach. But the point is that... Ashkenazim?
Yeah,
because they don't want people to think that we actually are able to bring the Korban Pesach to death.
Hmm? So it's no meat at all?
You can have meat, but not roasted. Okay. It could be cooked with a liquid, but not roasted without a liquid. That's the minhag. In any case, but so we do try to avoid the impression that, you know, we're all good, we have a temple here, and, you know, everything is hunky-dory. We try to remind ourselves all the time that the things we're doing which are reminiscent of the temple are only that, merely reminiscent. We shouldn't get confused and think that we're actually able to do those things now. So let's try to trace this a little bit and try to appreciate this a little bit more because, it's, you know, if you take the red pill, I'll show you how deep this rabbit hole goes.
Have you seen the videos?
So the Pasuk says, the Shabbos society
should answer that question.
As Shabbos society, Shmoru Mikdashi Tiro and Hashem. My Shabbos you shall guard. My temple you shall fear. I am God. That's the source, of course, of what the Chafetz Chaim was relating to. This is the pasuk from the Torah that says you're supposed to fear the temple. The Talmud asks a really interesting, or maybe not so interesting, maybe weird question on this. This is source number 7. Does anything bother you about the words "Umikdashi ti ra'u," fear my temple?
Yeah.
What bothers you about that?
Why should I be afraid when I go pray? Why should I? Shouldn't it be a moment of, you know, solace and?
Well, who said you're going to pray? You're going to the temple. You know what I'm saying?
Whatever. Going to the temple should be like something, a good occasion, not a fearful occasion.
Okay. So, Abe has one question. why should it be that we should have that? Why doesn't God say, you know, come and be excited? Or come and be, have a joyful experience? That's
also
one question.
Also,
okay.
Why should we fear this physical object as opposed to fear God?
Okay, so that's just bothering the topic. We'll come back. Abe will also answer your question with this.
Why
does
it
say the you're sophisticated. What?
I'm asking, I don't know.
Because they do not have
so
much
better
talent.
Wait, so what, you're answering this question? Okay, so Josh's question is, the words umiktashi tira'u means fear the temple. Now, what would we expect when it comes to fear? If God's going to command us to fear something, what would you expect him to say?
Him, himself.
Fear me, which we have.
So, yeah.
You're supposed to say, shalakecha tira'u, which is the fear of God. That we have psukim like that. Why are we being told to fear the temple? Isn't that strange?
It starts off with Shabbat.
What are you saying?
The sentence starts off with Shabbat.
Right. Guard the Shabbos
yeah.
and
but
fear
the
temple. Right.
In the temple, you still have the korban, like, you do all these things that you can't do outside.
Okay, so what does that mean?
So
why am I fearing the temple?
Well, I have an answer.
Wait, hold on. Sasha's trying to say. What?
Is it can go in there to the temple can confuse you about what you're supposed to do.
So explain, so what does it mean, fear the temple? What does it mean? Afraid, be afraid of the building collapsing? Well, what's the fear of the temple? What does it mean?
The concept.
Fear his presence in the temple. Fear what you... Be careful about
so Jared
you
already wants to make a medrash out of it. It doesn't mean fear the building. It
that's
means...
That's what you've been saying the whole time.
That's what I've been saying?
Yeah, you've been saying we have to be careful. There are a couple of times saying we have to be careful about what we want. We have to be careful about judgment within the temple.
Okay. Very. Yeah, you're right. Yeah.
I have an answer.
Yeah.
It doesn't mean literally fear the temple, but it means that we should be fearful because God doesn't want to make any mistakes when we go in there and make sacrifices. So we should be fearful. In other words, we should be careful to...
Okay, so no, very similar you know, to what Jared said. I mean, obviously it can't mean to be afraid of the building, right? It can't mean to be afraid of the building. So it might mean... Oh, so that's what the Talmud says, right? The Talmud says... Is it possible that a person should be afraid of the building? Talmud Lomar, that's why the Pasuk says, "Es Shabbos Osai Tishmaru, Es Mikdashi Tiroi." Guard my Shabbos and fear the temple. It's the same thing, they're parallel. You're guarding the Shabbos and you're fearing the temple, just like the guarding of Shabbos. You're not afraid of Shabbos. What do you mean, guarding Shabbos? I mean, you're keeping Shabbos and guarding it because God told you to. So it's a relationship, it's an observance that you're doing because of a fear of respect for God. So too, fear that's spoken about by the temple doesn't mean you're physically building, but rather he who instructed us to fear it. So what exactly does it mean, says the Talmud? Well, what is this kind of fear of the Mikdash then, according along the lines that we're describing? So that's what Jared was saying. Lo yikonis baharabayis b'maklo, a person shouldn't go on the temple mount with his walking stick, bimna'olo, when he's wearing his shoes, just remove your shoes, bepundaso, his money pouch, supposed to take off, uba avak shal gabi raglo, not with dust on his feet, he should wash his feet, lo yasinu kapandaria, he shouldn't make it into a shortcut, rakika mikal v'chomer, and spitting, for sure you couldn't do how much more so you
what do you mean?
Kabbalah
does it all the time.
Spit?
During the later. What?
Okay.
So is that, it's a, that's a problem right here.
The ainli ela this is only true when you have a temple. Bisman shebeis hamikdash kaya minayin. How do you know this is true when there's no temple? Talmud lomar Shabbos esai tishmor mikdashi tiro. Again, the connection between Shabbos and the temple, just like shemiras Shabbos, keeping Shabbos is applicable for all time. So too, fear that's spoken about by the temple is for all time. So the Chafetz Chaim is saying it doesn't only mean the Temple Mount itself. It means it applies for all time to whatever temple we have for all time, which today is the miniature temple, which is synagogues and study halls.
Does that answer our question?
Which question?
Of why are we fearing a building?
So the answer is we don't. The answer wasn't true. That was incorrect. We don't fear the building whatsoever. What it means to say is, yes, that's what it means. That's why it connects to Shabbos. You shouldn't have seen it. You're bothered by, well, then why does it say it like that?
Yeah.
So what's the answer? It says that you're supposed to fear the temple because it doesn't mean you're supposed to fear God. That's a separate pasuk. You're always supposed to fear God. When you're inside the temple, there are special observances. There are special things you're supposed to do in relationship to that place. When you're in the temple, you have to behave in a certain way. Now, you're only behaving that way out of fear of God, not fear of the building. But because the building has certain requirements, so it's referred to as fearing the temple. Yeah, that's the simple stuff. I would like to say something a little bit deeper soon. Why the Gemara even thought we should fear the temple. What a strange thing to even think. Well, what was it even thinking? And hopefully we'll be able to take this a step deeper and you'll be maybe even more satisfied. So we see clearly from the Chofetz Chaim, and he's not the first to say it, by the way, that was just, you know, he's was a nice concrete way, that a shul, a synagogue, is a miniature temple. And it means that, in a sense, that you fulfill a mitzvah from the Torah when you behave in shul. Yeah, you tell that to your kids. Behave in shul, it's a mitzvah, right? Not a good deed, it's a real mitzvah. Connection to God, right? Right, Meir? Connection to infinite, mitzvah?
Okay.
So, let's take a step back and try and understand, well, if the synagogue is supposed to be a miniature temple, and there's supposed to be this fear of the temple, can we just talk for a minute? What's the whole point of a temple? What kind of heresy is this, Abe? What, do you think God isn't everywhere?
So I think it's more like an awesome community.
If that's like what you said originally, right? We were asking, like, why should I pray in shul? Why don't I just pray in my room, right? I'm praying to God. God's everywhere. So it's the same answer, right?
Yeah.
That on a very practical level, right? On a very practical level, right? That's where everyone gets together. And it creates a community. It creates certainly, very often, a more powerful prayer because you have everyone getting together. That goes without saying, right? So certainly on a very practical level, that's 100% true. Is there anything more to it than that, Abe? Josh, is it just pragmatic? Rony!
Hi.
It also makes it kind of different and special. I mean, when you have a specific place to do something, it makes that...
It gives you a special feeling, and you're in a special place. But is there any reality to it? That's really what I want to know. Is it just for us? Is it just for us, Daniel?
Yeah.
The temple's just for us to have community, to have a place to meet. Is that all it is?
No.
Or is there more of a reality to it than that?
If you look at number 8...
We'll get to that. Can I share something with you guys? I want to share with you something beautiful. The Torah is a little bit long to read, you know? So what I want to do in about 2 minutes is give you the cliff notes. The cliff notes of the Rambam. The cliff notes of the Rambam. The Rambam was the first to create cliff notes on the Torah. So
I'm not a fan of cliff notes.
Why? It got me through high school.
It didn't get you through high school? We'll talk about that another time. So, here we go. You ready for this? This is what the Ramban says. You want to know what the basic storyline of the entire Torah is? As they say, all regel achas. In 2 minutes, it goes like this. Genesis, Bereishis, was the DNA of the history of the world. Everything happened right there. In other words, God created the world and created man. And he wanted to have a relationship with man. So, there developed and became men, namely Avraham, Yitzchak, and Yaakov, who actually became what the Ramban refers to as a chariot, a merkava for God. What is that supposed to mean? What's a chariot? It's something that, in the times of, you know, the ancients, brought something from one place to another. So what does it mean to be a chariot for God? To draw God, to bring God from one place to another. They were the chariot, the Merkava, that brought God into the world. How do you say world in Hebrew?
Olam.
Olam, which I think we mentioned before, is related to what word? Ne'elam. What's ne'elam? Disappeared. Aliyah, you're right, but ne'elam with a mem. Olam, ne'elam, ayin lam and mem, means something has vanished, something has disappeared. Why is a world called it disappeared? Well, because guess who disappeared when there became a world?
God.
And that also reflects the purpose of the world, is that we're supposed to now reveal God in the world. And that's ultimately really what it's all about. It's cool, right? So says the Ramban, that's what Avraham, Yitzchak, and Yaakov did. Yeah? That's the beginning. That's Genesis. And that's really the DNA of the entire world. That's what the world's all about. So this world created, sort of, so to speak, absent of God. Whole purpose of the world is to reveal God. And the mystery is when God is perfectly revealed. Done. Mashiach. Yeah? That's it. Done. Wait, but that's only Genesis. So what's the rest of the Torah all about? So can anybody summarize for me, just in like a word, how would you summarize the book of Shmos? What's the storyline basically? Good! Exodus. Chazal don't refer to it as Exodus.
Long.
Chazal actually referred to it not as the book of Exodus, of leaving, but does anybody know? It's called Sefer HaGe'ulah. What does Ge'ulah mean?
Redemption.
Chazal referred to it as the book of redemption. No, it sounds Exodus, redemption, what's the difference, right? Meaning they've been redeemed. They've been redeemed from Egypt, right? They've been taken out. Exodus. So the strangest thing, where does Shmos end? What's the storyline? Where does Shmos end? Does it end with the Exodus?
No. No. They're already in Israel. And like the building of the temple.
No, we're not in Israel until after
Shmos?
No, that's
oh, it begins.
Exodus.
It ends
the second book
in the
Torah.
Of the desert, doesn't it?
There are five books, right? There are five books in the Bible. The second one.
They're in the desert wandering. Yeah, it ends like in the middle of them being in the desert, no?
Right. Kind of. All the stories of the desert are in which book?
Bamidbar,
right? Bamidbar is like all the stories that happen in the desert and the spies and, you know, Miriam. Remember the picture? Yeah, Facebook, yeah? So that's all in Bamidbar, all those stories. Vayikra, what's Vayikra? What's Leviticus about? What does it mean, Leviticus?
It's the Levian, like
yeah,
the laws of the
sacrifices, the temple, right on, yeah? That's what Leviticus is all about. And what's Devarim?
I know this one.
What's Devarim?
I let someone else tell you
that. Daniel, what's Devarim?
Summary.
What, the one we're doing now?
Yeah.
It's like, it's all about like Moses in the beginning.
It's Moses' farewell speech, preparations going to the land of Israel, right?
Yeah. And what happens like that?
So says the Ramban, you know what's going on in Shmos? Shmos doesn't end with the Exodus. Why is it called Exodus then? So he says, well, it's not exactly called Exodus. It's called the Book of Redemption. Why? Because the Exodus, the redemption, actually ended with what? With what Sefer Shmos ends with. Well, what does Sefer Shmos end with? Come on, Abe. It ends with the construction of the...
Basically.
Not exactly.
The
I don't know
what do you call it?
Yeah, what do you call it?
Mishkan.
The Mishkan, yes. The tabernacle.
But it was the same thing.
The tabernacle is completed at the end of Sefer Shmos, Vayakel, Pikudei. Yeah, when we enumerate and we establish, we finally construct the Mishkan, the tabernacle, that is where Sefer Shmos ends. Jared, isn't that bizarre?
Yeah, so.
Why does it just end with the Exodus? If it's called the Book of Redemption, end with the redemption.
Because that is the redemption.
Ah! It is the redemption. Why is that the redemption?
Because that's what we live for, building tabernacles.
Okay. No, but what I mean to say, Abe, is that what was the exile that we're being redeemed from?
Slavery.
Well, we often think it was slavery, it was Egypt. Says the Ramban, no. Cliff notes again, right? 1, 2, 3 cliff notes. Again, the whole world, God created a world, God's absent from the world versus bring God into the world. Did that happen? Yes. On a certain level. The DNA. Who did that? Avraham, Yitzchak, and Yaakov did that. They became a Merkava for God's presence in the world. They brought God into the world. They did accomplish what the purpose of the world was on a DNA, miniature DNA level. It didn't happen in the world at large yet. That's the end of history. So the exile was what? The exile from the level of the Avos, the level of Avraham, Yitzchak, and Yaakov, the connection that they had, being this Merkava, this chariot for God, that was the exile. If that is the exile, what's the redemption? When once again they, what? They achieve that relationship again, where they once again become the Merkava. They become once again a chariot for God's presence, just like Avraham, Yitzchak, and Yaakov, which was accomplished with the building of the tabernacle. Right? That's why Shmos, the book of redemption, ends with the construction of the tabernacle. That is the end of the redemption.
Where are you getting all this from?
This is the Ramban.
Okay.
So again, so can we just get this clear? Jared, you ready? Sasha, you ready? Daniel, you ready?
Okay.
The cliff notes of the Torah is very simple. Genesis is the DNA. Yeah, God created a world. That's the beginning. God vanished from the world because there's a world. And God's waiting for man to bring him in. Okay, that's part one of the Torah. Part two is basically how that happened in history, which is very simple. Jews built the Mishkan. You got it? Whole Torah. The rest of, you know, history is like just bringing that into reality. Building the temple and then like getting everybody to come and serve God in. Okay, good?
No.
The entire Torah.
Not good.
That was pretty clear, right?
But I like notes.
Everything else? What's everything else? Leviticus is just about how to keep God's presence there by doing the sacrifices right. But Midbar, all right, we'll throw in a few stories along the way for inspiration. And Devarim is just a summary and getting ready to go into the land of Israel and make it all, you know, fulfilled.
I like it. Let's do it.
But do you hear how that's like a summary of the entire Torah? According to the Ramban, that's basically that's the outline of the entire Torah.
Let's do it.
Okay,
what's the difference between the tabernacle and the base of Mikdash? The base of Mikdash is like the place, and the tabernacle is where you put the sacrifices?
According to the Ramban, the tabernacle was the temporary base of Mikdash until they were in the land of Israel, where they could actually concretize it and make it a permanent base.
Okay.
But it was the same thing.
Okay.
In the time remaining, I want to try and share with you a complicated idea. Don't get nervous. I want to explain to you, with that in mind, everything we just said, what the tabernacle actually represents. And the Beis HaMikdash, therefore, actually represents. And what a synagogue, therefore, actually represents. Are you with me? You ready? You'll like this. Brown. The Ramban sees really unusual things in the Mishkan. And he wonders about that. What are the three things? Whoever took me for, what did we learn? About Midbar, a long time ago. Yeah, you were there. So we spoke, and Alex, you were
that's
there.
Space.
We spoke about the structure of the camp.
Oh, yeah.
The camp had what's called four degalim. What's a degal?
Flag.
A flag. There were four flags, meaning the entire Jewish people at the time were divided basically into four camps. And the Levites, you know, the ones who were serving the Mishkan in the middle.
Just like right now. You got Orthodox, you got Syrian.
Not exactly. So what were the four groups? Does anybody know? What were these four? How were they divided up into four groups? There was the group of Reuven, Ephraim, Yehuda, and Dan.
Yeah.
Okay. Now each one of them had a flag, and on the flag there was a picture of something. So what were the pictures? What were on these flags? Yehuda. Does anybody know Judah?
Lion.
Was a lion, right?
No, just give me the picture. That's Don. I think Don is a fish.
Judah.
Reuven. What is Reuven famous for?
He
was the one that was bringing his mother Leah the flowers. That was the reproductive medicine at the time. The Dudaim. So that she could produce children. So on Reuven's flag was an image of either the flowers or a person. No,
flowers?
A person. The Dudaim, which were fertility medication. A person. A person was on his flag. Ephraim was the son of who? Who was Ephraim's father? Ephraim and Manasseh both came from?
Zilpah.
The father. Their father. Who's their father?
Yaakov.
No, remember, Ephraim and Manasseh were actually the children of Yosef.
Oh, okay.
And Yosef is referred to as the Bechor Shor, as he's a Bechor in a certain sense. He's the firstborn of Rachel, and he's referred to as an ox.
so they lost.
So Ephraim had on his flag an ox. What's left, of course? Remember, this goes back to the beginning of Yechezkel. Uh-oh, we're starting to approach an answer why we should pray in the synagogue based on Yechezkel. What was on, of course, the flag of Dun, then? What's only left? No. But?
A judgment.
Usually
a
Dun,
snake.
Usually it's a snake. Usually it's depicted as a snake, but the Midrashim here say that's not what was on the banner of his that banner when he was the group, or wasn't it before? What was on his banner as the Degel Machane Dun was an eagle.
Oh, it's like the...
Where did we see this, these images
like
before?
The chariot.
Right here.
That's
in
right.
Yechezkel.
In Yechezkel, he says the four faces of the Chayos were these four images, and those four images are reflected by the structure of the camp. What was in the middle of the camp?
The tabernacle.
The tabernacle. What surrounded the camp on all four sides? A lion, an ox, an eagle,
and a person.
Whoa. Whoa. Number two. Everyone's bothered by this. You know, God tells us to build a tabernacle, and he tells us, don't make graven images. Don't bow down to graven images. Bad thing. And then he says, but you know, when you build this temple, I want you to make me some kulim. Cherubs.
What?
Cherubs. Cherubim.
Yeah, I didn't know what that was.
The kruvim are some sort of depiction of like an angel with a baby's face.
Oh, are those the ones that used to turn away when they were
that's
fighting?
Right. So on top of the ark were kruvim, these cherubs.
Get them out of here.
And that's where God spoke between those kruvim. Yeah?
Yeah.
So everybody wants to know, why in the world did God command us to build an ark with kruvim on it?
Right. Good question.
Where else did we see kruvim? When
here.
We started today, where did we see kruvim?
In the flags.
Again, in Yechezkel's vision, not the flags, but in Yechezkel's vision of God's throne, of God's chariot, again, Yechezkel says, in his second vision, which was really the first vision, of course, right? In the second vision, he says, this time I saw that God was riding on top of...
chariot.
On top of...
Cherubim.
That's number two. We're going to put it all together in a second. And number three, the Ramban says that when God tells Moses to get together 70 elders, and the 70 elders had to sit in what's called the Lishkas HaGozis, yeah, the Sanhedrin, used to sit partially in the temple. You aware of this? You had to be next to the Mizbeach, because the Mizbeach is commanded right at the end of the Ten Commandments, right?
Anyways.
What? That they were sitting juxtaposed to the Mizbeach.
Wow.
Eila Mishpatim comes right after the commandment for the Mizbeach. So Sanhedrin is supposed to sit juxtaposed to the Mizbeach. And there are a lot of messages in that. We could give a Givaldic share about that another time. But bottom line is, why 70? Why does it have to be a representation of 70 as part of the temple? Says the Ramban, because we know from Torah Sheba Al Peh that there were 70 angels that surround God's throne of glory. What do you see from all this? Said straight up, these are signs that it's true, proofs that it's true. But it's said straight up in source number 8. The Mechilta, when it says Machon L'Shivtecha Pa'alta Hashem, which is a little bit hard to translate, Machon L'Shivtecha. Shivtecha Shabbos means a resting place. Machon, what's Machon? The place of your resting? It's just a reference to what? So the Medrash says Machon can be read as Mechuvan. Mechuvan means things that are like juxtaposed, adjacent, they're like right next to each other. This is Mechuvan to this. It's just right opposite. Fits in right next to it. Mechuvan. What's Mechuvan L'Shivtecha? What's right opposite your resting place, God?
The chair of the bed.
The angels.
God's thrown down here.
I don't know, but you were...
Which is a reference to the temple.
He says, shall be top.
In other words, this Medrash is incredible. It says, Ze echelina devarim, shekisei shel mata, hu mechuvan kenegad kisei shel mala. The throne of God down here is exactly connected, opposite, the kisei above. In other words, God's throne in our world is what?
The temple.
But
the temple or temples?
The Beis HaMikdash. The Mishkan, the Beis HaMikdash, ultimately, that place of Beis HaMikdash is exactly opposite God's throne in Shemayim. And what's impressive about this Medrash to me is that it doesn't say that God's temple down here is opposite his chair up there. It says his chair down here. Do you hear what that means? It means that the temple is God's throne in our world. That's why it comes along with all of these details that the Ramban is mentioning. That it's surrounded by these digalim, these flags which represent the chayos. And it has kruvim, because God sits on kruvim. So the kruvim are represented. His throne is represented in our world by the ark with the kruvim on top of it. And the 70 elders have to be sitting in the temple, because again, that was one of the elements of God's throne above, is that there are these 70 ministering angels. They are represented by the 70 chachamim in the Sanhedrin, and the head on top making it 71. So what does this have to do with us? Hey, what do you say? If you say this, is there any possibility of fearing the temple?
This is a yes or no question.
maybe.
Is there any possibility of fearing the temple?
If you take what I just said seriously,
that
the temple is God's throne room in our world.
Then
there's a reality to the temple, right?
Right.
There's a reality to the throne room. This is something that's a little bit scary. The place itself has an aura to it.
Dalit Nehemiah Talmud.
Well, that's because of God.
Okay.
But we're talking about the throne room itself, even when God, to speak, if he wouldn't be there. It's the throne room. You hear what I'm saying?
Yes.
So there's a strong hava amina. One could imagine that there should be a fear of the temple itself. Josh, you hear what I'm saying? Because the temple is God's throne. When you approach the throne, you're suddenly encountering the king's throne.
Fear.
Even if the king's not sitting on it right now. Understand? This is the throne. There's an awe to it. There's a power to it. So I think that's why it says Mikdashi Tira'u. Not just because of course, what's correct, that we fear God and God said fear the temple. But the Gemara even had a Hava Amina. It was thinking originally, well, maybe I should be afraid of the temple itself. Right? Remember, Josh, is what you asked originally. Why should you be afraid of the temple? I'll tell you why you should be afraid of the temple. Because God's throne room. There's a reality to the temple. So what does this mean for our shuls today?
That it's God's temple's definition. A throne, so.
That means that apparently the shul is a miniature throne.
If you follow the whatever it is, Chofetz Chaim.
Oh.
Yeah.
Right. So that's what the Chofetz Chaim is saying.
What if we don't follow it? What if I follow someone else? I'm just saying.
This is a fact. Meaning that's what the Chofetz Chaim is saying. Whether how seriously you take the concept of there's a mitzvah asei deraisa or not, but this approach 100% is correct.
Everyone
the mikdash ma'at, whether it's the deraisa or not, I don't know. Maybe not.
Okay.
But the imagery, the concept, everyone agrees to. It's called a mikdash ma'at. So therefore, our synagogues, our study halls have shechina in them, have God's presence in them. It's a miniature throne room of God. So, can anybody tell me how you see the temple when you walk into a shul?
What do you mean by your question?
I don't know. When you walk into a shul, do you see anything about the temple when you walk in? Is there anything that represents
the temple? I have no idea.
The arum. What about the arum?
That's
why I asked you,
like,
your clarifier
question.
Yo! Wait, so what'd he say?
It kind of reminds us of an iron in the temple, I guess.
Do you know why the Torah is in an ark? Do you know why the Torah is in an ark?
Because that's how it was in the temple.
Because you can't see
it. It's an interesting question. You don't think about it, right? Because we're so used to it. Why don't you just keep the Torah on the shelf with all the other books? Why does it have to be in an ark with a cover? Isn't it an interesting question that we take for granted? You know what the Rambam writes? The Rambam writes, guess what's written in the Torah? The Ten Commandments, right? Where were the Ten Commandments written? On luchos, on tablets. Do you know that tablets have a halacha? They're supposed to be kept in an arum. God says the luchos must be in an arum. So the Rambam writes, every Sefer Torah wears a couple of hats. It's a Torah. But guess what? It's also a luchos. It's also luchos, because written in it is the Ten Commandments. Therefore, a Torah is luchos, and must be kept in an ark. And of course, the ark in the temple had a paroches, had a curtain. So we keep it in an ark with a curtain. Okay, let's move back a little bit. What about the menorah? Is there a menorah in the shul?
No.
Well, on Hanukkah there for sure is. Who says you should light a Hanukkah? You should light a menorah in the shul?
You're
supposed to light it in your house.
There's a menorah in the shul all the time.
Where?
In the front.
Where?
Outside
the
doors.
Right next to the yard.
Stop asking so many questions.
It's in
my shul.
What light is constantly burning in the shul?
Oh, the...
The Ner Tami.
Yeah.
Even when it's not Hanukkah, there's constant Ner Tamid. You know why? Because
Ner
the middle...
Ner Tamid.
Because there was constantly, the menorah constantly had a light that was going. They lit it from that one, and when all the other ones had burned out, one still really kept going all the time. It was a miracle in the temple all the time, and there was a Ner Tamid in the menorah.
Oh, really?
It was constantly
one
burned.
Candle.
One candle, they lit from it, and it was still lit. They had to put it out last, because it was still lit after all the other ones. We're still...
That's why
Bonaro,
they always have...
The Ner Tamid. So the menorah is there in the Ner Tamid. Anything else? You know, there's something that's raised like up on high and it's in the center of the shul?
The
bima?
The bima's
in the middle. Why is it usually raised up? You have to take steps up to it? What was like that in the temple? The Mizbeah. The Mizbeah, when they brought the sacrifice, he had to walk up a ramp to get up to it. And by the way, what do we use it for, the Bima? We read the Torah from it. And on every Yontif, do you know specifically what we read? We read about the sacrifices. For real. You know, when Abraham had his circumcision, God says, you know, I'm going to give you the land of Israel, and you're going to build a temple, your children are going to have all this. And he says, how do I know they're not going to lose it? God says, don't worry, they're going to bring sacrifices, so it'll be able to atone for them. And Abraham says, well, wait a second, what happens if the temple is going to be destroyed? What's going to be? And God says, don't worry, when they learn about the sacrifices, I'll consider it like they brought them. So that's what we do. Even on Rosh Chodesh, we read the sacrifices from the Bima because we're bringing a sacrifice. That's the Mizbeah. What else? What about Ketores, incense?
What about it?
That's the Amud. There was a Mizbeach for Ketores in the temple. You know what I'm talking about?
No.
Oh. Inside, there was a structure. I can't tell them, but there's no markers in here. But in the structure of the temple, outside of the temple, that's why it's in the center of a shul, is the altar. Inside that building, the sanctuary, there were three vessels. The menorah, the shulchan, where the showbread was, the lechem apanim, and in the middle was an altar for incense. And then past the curtain, on the inside, was, of course, the aron. So far we've accounted for the aron. We've accounted for the menorah. We've accounted for the altar for sacrifices. And prayer is referred to as incense. So where the chazan davens from, that amud, where the chazan davens from, is the altar for incense. There's only one thing missing. The shulchan, for the shofar. If anybody can give me a satisfying answer for what happened to the shulchan and shul, I'll give you an A in the class.
Really?
It has to be a satisfying answer.
Wait, what's the question? Sorry. Let me write this down.
Shuls have kitchens.
I just finished explaining. It's on tape. Can you give us?
What's the official question? The
question is, I think that every single vessel of the temple has been represented in the synagogue in some way. And I just explained every single one, except for one.
The shulchan.
The shulchan.
The
table where the showbread was. The lechem hapanim.
Can more than one person get the right answer?
I don't know the answer.
If I get you a satisfying answer.
Yeah, wait, what do you mean
satisfying
answer?
Hold on, for both classes, for the Monday, Wednesday, and the Tuesday. Deal, I'll find it for you.
I'm an honest guy.
That's it?
This leads up to the next topic, which we're going to finish for today. What I want to approach now is how prayer relates to sacrifice, and that's where we're headed. This is a good introduction to that topic.
Isn't there something that don't spit in shul?